to the world.
Tango!
lot of music tonight. You guys are salty. You're salty. You're very quiet and attentive, too. I think by this time you'd have license to be more than mildly unruly. I mean, you could really kind of come unhinged. Take it off. All right. I mean, if you want to see that.
I guess I should do you a picking song of his, since that's what he was known for. The most influential guitarist of the 20th century. People that followed in his footsteps, people like Chet Atkins, Jerry Reed, Mark Knopfler, even Eric Clapton said he got some of that from Travis. Scotty Moore with Elvis. Scott Moore's my buddy. Anyway, Travis used to pick like this. Thank you very much. Boy, you're really nice. I'll make you a deal. If you ever do anything, or if you're doing anything tonight, you'd like me to come over and watch you do it and clap for you when you're finished? What the hell? Let me know. I owe you one.
Fresh Digital TV.
I've got a song I'm going to do for you right now that I have done for years and years, ever since it came out in a movie called Deliverance. It's a song called Dueling Banjos, and I never play without playing this song. And so you'll understand what's happening. I play both parts at the same time. I do the guitar part for you folks on this side of the auditorium, and the banjo part for you folks on this side. Then when I get in the middle, that's when I put them both together and pray a lot. So are you ready? This is Dueling Banjos.
Okay, guitar part.
Thank you.
Just recently happened in Russia, and that was this mutiny led by, as us lay folk may say, a mercenary group, an army for hire, if you will, called the Wagner Group. That's how I would say it, having spent time abroad, but here in the United States, the Wagner Group. And can you explain how is it? One interesting thing that I like to share with people is, did you know it's illegal in Russia for the government to hire mercenaries? And they sort of have gotten around these things in a variety of kind of protracted interpretations and agreements. But setting that little factoid aside, how is it that the Wagner Group has such a massive presence and that they're such an integral part of Russia's war in Ukraine? And who are the players, and what sort of sides of the argument, if you will, do they represent, with Prigozhin and the Wagner Group on one hand, and then sort of some of these other, like Shoigu and the others on the other, if you would, Professor?
Yeah, so initially the reason for these private military companies is that they would do actions for the Russian government, but with plausible deniability. So another government wants somebody to do something, and Russia could send Wagner troops there and claim they had no idea. Russia has long claimed they don't know anything about Wagner. They don't fund them.
Right.
They just have no idea of anything. Prigozhin even sued a reporter in the UK for libel for claiming that he was the head of Wagner. So up until the Ukraine war, the Russian government just denied they had anything to do with Wagner. And it was not a threat to the regular Russian military, because they were doing different things that they didn't want the regular Russian military associated with, operating in African countries and different kinds of things like that.
Intentionally, but non-overlapping circles of operation, yes, if yes, you will, right?
Yes. So that was all fine. But when the war in Ukraine started going badly and the regular Russian military needed help, Wagner seemed like kind of special forces, highly trained, that maybe they could come in and help out. And they went to Bakhmut, that maybe people have heard about, and they actually, even though they never fully got control of Bakhmut, they had some successes there. So, and they also recruited from prisoners, and Prigozhin had himself spent 10 years in prison. So he knew these prison norms and the prison lingo and all this kind of stuff. So Wagner looked actually like it was helpful in the war in Ukraine, and they were doing well. But this put them into immediate competition with the regular Russian military, because suddenly, mm-hmm, instead of it being in their own lane out somewhere else, they're competing with the Russian military. They looked like they were doing better, and they wanted more money, more resources, more men, etc. And this set up the power struggle between Prigozhin, the head of Wagner, and the Russian military.
It's a fascinating sort of evolution of that, right? And at the same time, you have these power players, right? Perhaps, the castles and the knights and the bishops on a chessboard. You have the rank and file members of both the Wagner Group, but also the Russian military, and a lot of reporting coming up about, for lack of a better term, and though it's been well trod, dissension in the ranks, right?
Yes.
And the challenges happening within the formal Russian military structure. Can you speak a little bit about the interplay and the action that's going on more in the rank and file as opposed to those knights, castles, and bishops on the chessboard?
Well, this is one of the most interesting things, because when Wagner made this appeal to Putin, they first went to Rostov. Rostov is important. It's a city in southern Russia, but it's the head of the Southern Military Command headquarters. That's where the whole operation of Ukraine is being managed from. So it's not just any random city. It's where they're managing the war from Ukraine. He goes into the military headquarters and says, I want Shoigu and Gerasimov, the chief of staff, chief of general staff, and the defense minister. And they have fled. And so he sits down and does a video with two other generals. And they kind of laugh and joke with him. He's like, I want these guys. And one of them says, like, okay, go ahead and take them. Okay.
So again, and just so everybody's got the players here, this is Prigozhin, the one that just led this mutiny and now seems to maybe be sort of back in the fold. And he's speaking about two leaders of the Russian formal military structure, Shoigu and I always blank on the other guys. Gerasimov.
Yes, the defense minister and the chief of the general staff. So the two top people. Gerasimov is the head of all the operations in Ukraine. The number
It'd be like
person,
the joint chiefs, you know, the head of the joint chiefs and the head of the DOD or something like that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the number two person is Surovikin. Surovikin and Alexeyev are ones who immediately put out these videos telling Wagner forces to stop, to not march on Moscow. Now, one of those guys who put out the video is seen joking later with Prigozhin. The other one, Surovikin, he's the head of the whole Russian air forces and space forces, the aerospace forces. He's the number two person in the whole war effort in Ukraine. And he is just missing. Since this whole thing happened, since that video where he looks kind of like a hostage, no one has seen him. Now, that's not just anybody that disappeared. It's a important person.
Yeah, it's the head of the Air Force, basically.
Yes, and Space Forces. And also, you know, the issue of the rank and file, what's really interesting is the Wagner forces, they easily take the Rostov building, and then they start heading, part of their forces start heading to Moscow. And they face no resistance, except the military, the regular Russian military sent some helicopters and an airplane, and they shot down 6 helicopters and an airplane, the single biggest loss for Russian aviation in the whole war, done by Wagner, not
right.
by Ukraine.
This is not, Americans don't realize that this actually just happened.
Yes.
This would have been as if Blackwater shot down a U.S.
Yes.
helicopter.
And killed 12 pilots.
And killed our own, so like your own mercenaries that you've hired are now killing U.S. forces.
Yes.
That would be the equivalent here. So that's where we get.
Yes. And then the question is, like, why doesn't Putin or the regular army stop Prigozhin? They get to within 200 kilometers to Moscow. And I think one of the reasons is they did not know, the Russian government did not know how much support they had. They were doubting how much support there would be for Wagner forces among their own forces.
Amongst
the
rank and file, yes.
Very risky thing to say, let's fight them. And instead you got this negotiated settlement via Lukashenko in Belarus. And suddenly Wagner says, okay, never mind, we're leaving. We're going to Belarus. We're going to have Wagner forces join the Russian regular military. But today we learned that Prigozhin was given amnesty and he was supposed to go to Belarus. Or the people who participated in the mutiny were given amnesty. Prigozhin, they just said, well, you know, we don't know anything about him. We have no idea. He's like wherever he is.
Yep.
And then it turns out he was meeting with Putin on June 29th.
On June 29th, yes.
The intrigue builds because I don't think the Russian government knew where the loyalty of the army exactly was among the rank and file and the people that would have to do the fighting. And they clearly knew that there were some people at the top who were siding with Prigozhin. Possibly they knew that. Possibly Surovikin was one of them, and that's why he's been detained. But just today, Gerasimov showed up on TV in a video, so that suggests he hasn't been fired. But
of course, no one knows when the video was made, right? So there's that level, too.
But it's a signal of support. And the thing is, if Putin fires Shoigu and Gerasimov, who are widely disliked in the military, then it looks like Prigozhin has won.
Right.
And if he keeps them in, it's more incompetence for the Russian military.
Yeah, it just, so with that point, right, like the reason that Putin did not order the military to affirmatively push the Wagner group back, some are hypothesizing, was that he didn't know how many of the rank and file would join the Wagner group, which brings me to my final question. We've got about a minute and a half, so you're going to have to be really efficient. Professor, what's going to happen in Ukraine?
Okay, I have an easy answer. The war is going to end when Ukraine gets the weapons and supplies that it needs from the United States and European allies. That is the only thing that is going to end the war. There is going to be no peace, no change of mind by Putin. The war is going to end when Ukraine gets the ammunition and supplies that it needs to end the war. And the sooner that we support Ukraine in that, the sooner the war ends.
Yeah, the fewer people die. I mean,
yes.
I the reason that I wanted to have you on was because I don't think most average Americans really realize the scale of the importance, right, that is going on in that conflict, how absolute the stakes could not be higher when it comes to NATO and whether or not Ukraine is eventually able to turn back the invaders. Last question for you. You got 30 seconds now. Is Putin still in power in 5 years, Professor?
No.
No, you heard it here. I love it. We will have you back, Professor, if you will come back. This is so fascinating. You have so much to share. Thank you for being here. You heard it here. The war ends in Ukraine when we finally get them what they need to push back Russia. And Putin is not in power in 5 years on the Maggie Don Show.
WMDX. Tom Alba Show on Mad Radio. 92.7 WMDX.
Are listening to the Maggie Don Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. You can join us for this last segment of this Monday at 844-967-2789. Got to start with a huge thanks to our last guest, Professor Yoshiko Herrera from UW-Madison, breaking down all things Russia and Ukraine, throwing a little Crimea because Crimea was just a table setter for what is now a very long war and very costly war in Ukraine. We asked her two fundamental bottom line questions at the end of that segment. How does the war end? What happens in Ukraine? And she said, Ukraine and the war ends when we give them enough weaponry and support for them to successfully push Russia back. Otherwise, the war will just continue ad nauseum. It is not a possibility that Russia ends up with Ukraine. Nope, not going to happen. And then secondly, I asked her, is Putin still in power in 5 years? And she said, nope. So heard it here first. Mark the day and time. It is June 10th, 2024 at about 6:51 p.m. So my thanks to Professor Herrera from the University of Wisconsin. We'll have to get her back, Evan. She was just fantastic.
It was amazing. I guess the punditry that I've grown used to hearing, it's not decisive like this. I mean, to really hear somebody with the knowledge, the history, with the picture and the focus, just tell us what, I mean.
Yeah, experts are experts, right? Like they actually know what they're talking about. The stark difference is huge, right? You're not listening to Dippy Doos, also called Senator Tommy Tuberville, talking about foreign policy from some hackneyed, righty GOP pro-Trumpian, somehow Putin's not that bad, nonsensical perspective. No, it's like, yep, Putin's bad. It's an autocracy, always has been. He's an authoritarian. Here's how he's operating in the country. Like, it's not a debate. These the facts.
I really appreciated the picture that she sort of painted as far as how is that government structured? You know, we think of sort of a quote unquote president like Putin. It's way more complicated than that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was incredible. I really look forward to hearing from her again.
Absolutely. So again, thanks to you, Yoshiko. Nailed it. So Before I sort of put the bookend on today's show, I just, the sound was too good to possibly pass up. Your comedic relief in the U.S. House of Representatives, yours and mine, as always and ever, now federally indicted Representative George Santos in full martyr mode. And check out who he decides to compare himself to.
I just have to say, before I play this man is younger than I am. He is 34 years old, and it's just shocking to think that you could walk into any bar in the country and grab a random man off of a stool in said bar. They would be a better senator than he. It's incredible. Yeah, let's check this out.
I mean, Mitt Romney, the man goes to the State of the Union of the United States wearing a Ukraine lapel pin, tells me, a Latino gay man, that I shouldn't sit in the front, that I should be in the back. Well, guess what? Rosa Parks didn't sit in the back, and neither am I going to sit in the back. That's just the reality of how it works. Mitt Romney lives in a very different world, and he needs to buckle up because it's going to be a bumpy ride for him.
Bumpy ride.
He's Rosa Parks now, everybody. You can be gay and Latino, and you can also be an absolute piece of crap, right? A lying, swindling, fraudster of the highest order. And maybe, just maybe, sir, Mitt Romney doesn't want you to sit next to him, and McConnell doesn't want you to sit next to him because you're a lying, conning, fraudster, pathological nightmare when it comes to anybody that tries to make an argument about ethics and morality. Yeah, because you stink so bad, sir. That's why they don't want to sit next to you.
Have we seen anything like him before? It's shocking. I like my politics.
Yeah, like think
boring.
Tammany Hall.
Incredible.
Right? Like I don't know. The best I can use is everything that we know about this man. It requires the conclusion like he is a confidence man. Like, that's just what he does. And so the more outlandish the statement, like, oh, I'm the Rosa Parks of the House of Representatives, like, give me a break. The more outlandish the statement, often for pathological liars and con men, the easier it is to say, right? And there's also, you know, someone that behaves as this man does. This is also pathological narcissism, right? At the highest level. If it's happening to me and it's bad, it's because someone has it out for me and I'm being treated unfairly and the world isn't supposed to work like this and I'm a victim, right? That's what pathological narcissists do.
And he just rose.
Lo and behold, he's Rosa Parks now.
And in a position of power, no less. It's amazing to me how this happened. I just don't know how
by
it happened.
By the sheer audacity of the lies,
yes.
Right? You lie small, you do not become a congressman if you're George Santos. Like, you had to go for the gusto, and gusto he did got. We'll see when it lands him in the clink for a number of years. I wonder how it'll go over when he says to his celly, hey, you can't do that to me because I'm just like Rosa Parks because I'm gay and Latino. I don't know if that's going to work for him. So you might want to rethink that tactic, Mr. Santos. I couldn't leave today without bookending this whole discussion, right? We start with college football coach Tommy Tuberville placing the national security of our country at risk in our military preparedness. That's what the GOP thinks about the military and what it means to abide the oath that we take to serve and protect our country. And at the other end of the spectrum, we have jock jams for government jobs, CrossFit for civic duty, the pumping to be president. A bunch of these dips are online arguing about how fast they run a mile. That's what we've been reduced to. I don't even want to read the copy on this because it's so disgusting. But suffice it to say, a bunch of bimbos. And yeah, I'm using the word bimbo here, everybody. Do not text or call the show to complain about this. I'm using bimbos to refer to men here, and thus it is not sexist. These bimbos buffooning around, showing off their buff bods, because that's what is apparently now a good credential to be president. I couldn't make stuff like this up. So pathetic. Literally, it's this Francis Suarez, mayor of Miami, Vivek Ramaswamy, We got Robert Kennedy Jr. We even have 72-year-old Asa Hutchinson getting in on the who's more ripped argument. For real, everybody. Whew. That's a scary place to be in our country. Listen, I'll be back tomorrow with my good friend Erica from the Patriotic Millionaires. We'll be talking to you about the HAPS in Richland Center on July 12th. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. Thanks for listening, everybody.